We are in a series called Wisdom for Today, and we are looking at the five books of wisdom. In the Old Testament, we have books of history, and we have books of prophecy, but right in the middle, right in the heart of the Old Testament, there are five books of wisdom. I think back there they need some. There we go. And in those books, we find the poetry, Hebrew poetry. And for some of us, it's a little hard to grasp because Hebrew poetry is not does not rhyme necessarily. It rhymes in thought, either in a contrast or in a enhancement. And so there's different kinds of poetry that are put together. The book of Ecclesiastes, if you just read it lightly, you'll probably think, wow, that is one disappointed and sorrowful writer. Because it seems like the writer is absolutely down on everything. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. Nothingness, nothingness, all is nothingness. But if you continue to read, you'll see that what we are finding here is the author saying to us, if you don't look in the right place, life is miserable and meaningless. But if you look in the right place, you will learn how to enjoy life. Now, we have a video again, and I think we're geared up and ready to go. And we're going to watch this. If you cannot see the screen, please feel free to move so you can. These videos are very short and precise, and you'll like it.
The book of Ecclesiastes. It's part of the Bible's wisdom literature, and it opens with this line. The words of Kohelet, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now, in Hebrew, the word Kohelet means someone who has gathered people together. And in this case, it's to learn, so it's often translated in English as teacher. And the teacher is said to be a son or a descendant of King David. And so there are different views about who this figure might have been. Many think that it refers to King Solomon. Others to maybe one of the later kings of David's line, and still others think that it's actually a later Israelite teacher who has adopted a Solomon-like persona as a teaching aid. Whichever of these views is correct, the key thing is to recognize that the teacher is a character in the book and is different than the author of the book, who remains anonymous. So we do hear the teacher's voice for most of the book, but it's actually a different voice, the author, who introduces us to the teacher in the first sentence, and then at the end concludes the book by summarizing and evaluating everything the teacher just said. So the author is someone who wants us to hear all that the teacher has to say, and then help us process it and form our own conclusion. So what does the teacher have to say? Well, the author summarizes the teacher's basic message at the beginning and right at the end, and it's hevel, hevel. Everything is utterly hevel. Now, most English Bibles translate this word hevel as meaningless, but that doesn't quite capture the heart of the idea. In Hebrew, hevel literally means vapor or smoke, and the teacher uses this word 38 times in the book as a metaphor to describe how life is, first of all, temporary or fleeting, like a wisp of smoke, but secondly, also how life is an enigma or a paradox. Like smoke, it appears solid, but when you try and grab onto it, there's nothing there. So there's so much beauty or goodness in the world, but just when you're enjoying it, tragedy strikes and it all seems to blow away. Or we all have a strong sense of justice, but all the time bad things happen to good people. So life is constantly, it's unpredictable, it's unstable, or in the teacher's words, like chasing after the wind. Hevel. Now that's kind of a downer. So why is he saying all of this? The author's basic goal is to target all of the ways that we try to build meaning and purpose in our lives apart from God. And he lets the teacher deconstruct these. So the author thinks we spend most of our time investing energy and emotion in things that ultimately have no lasting meaning or significance. And he lets the teacher give us a hard lesson in reality. You can see this most clearly in the opening and closing poems, which focus first of all on time and then on death. So the teacher says, you can spend your whole life working and achieving because you think that makes your life meaningful. You should really stop and consider the march of time. For all of the human effort that takes place in the world, nothing really ever changes. So sure, we develop technology and we build nations that rise and fall, but go climb a mountain and see if it cares. It was there long before any of us, and it will be here long after. I mean, no one's even going to remember you or anything you did 100 years from now, but that mountain, it'll still be there. And the ocean will still be breaking on the beach, and the sun will still rise and set. And so time will eventually erase you and me and everything that we care about. And if that's not disheartening enough, the teacher also can't stop talking about death all the way through the book, but especially in this poem near the end. He says, death is the great equalizer, and it renders meaningless most of our daily activities. It devours the wise and the fool, the rich and the poor, no matter who you are, what you've done, good or bad, we're all going to die, and it's inescapable. So with these two ideas in hand, the teacher goes on to consider all the activities and false hopes that we invest our lives in to find meaning and significance, like wealth or career or social status or pleasure. So you think working hard is going to make life worth it? Think about the stress and the toll that that takes on you, all the anxiety and the sleepless nights. And by the time you actually earn some wealth, you're going to be too old to enjoy it anyway. And then by the time that you have to pass it on to someone, they may not even be someone who cares about anything that you did. Or maybe you think pleasure is going to make life worth it for you. Go for it. You know, live for your vacations, live for the weekend party. Monday always comes. Hevel, hevel. Everything is utterly hevel. So what does the teacher advocate then? That we become pure hedonists or relativists? Well, no, that would be hevel too. The teacher acknowledges the ideas from Proverbs that living by wisdom and the fear of the Lord, that these have real advantages. On the whole, life will probably go better for you. See, but the problem is that even living by wisdom and the fear of the Lord, they're hevel too. Because they don't guarantee a good life. Good people die tragically, and horrible people live long and prosper. There's just too many exceptions. And so even wisdom is a hevel. Again, not meaningless, but an enigma. Wisdom doesn't work the way you think it should all of the time. So what's the way forward in the midst of all this hevel? And here, paradoxically, the teacher discovers the key to the true enjoyment of life under the sun. It's accepting hevel. It's acknowledging that everything in your life is totally out of your control. About 6 different times at some of the bleakest moments in his monologue, the teacher talks about the gift of God, which is the enjoyment of simple, good things in life, like friendship or family, a good meal or a sunny day. You can't control these things. You're certainly not guaranteed them, but that's their beauty. When I come to adopt a posture of total trust in God, it frees me to simply enjoy my life as I actually experience it, not as I think it ought to be. Because even my expectations about what life ought to be are ultimately hevel, hevel. Everything under the sun is utterly hevel. And so the teacher's words come to a close. Right here at the end, the author speaks up again, and he brings it all to a conclusion. He says, the teacher's words are very important for us to hear. He likens them to a shepherd's staff with a goad, a pointy end, which might hurt when it pokes you, but he says the teacher is trying to poke you to get you to move in the right direction, towards greater wisdom. The author then warns us that you can actually take the teacher's words too far. And you could spend your whole life buried in books trying to answer life's existential puzzles. Don't try, he says. You'll never get there. And so instead, the author offers his own conclusion, and it's this. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of humans, for God will bring every deed into judgment, every hidden thing, whether good or evil. And so the author thinks it's good to let the teacher challenge your false hopes and remind you that time and death make most of life completely out of your control. But what gives life true meaning is the hope of God's judgment, the hope that one day God will clear away all of the hevel and bring true justice to our world. And it's that hope that should fuel a life of honesty and integrity before God, despite the fact that I remain puzzled by most of life's mysteries. And that's the wisdom of the book of Ecclesiastes.
as you read the book of Ecclesiastes, you realize exactly what he said. There's two voices. The voice in chapter 1 and in chapter 12, the end, are talking in third person. He said this. He said this. And then through the middle of it, it is I. I tried this. I tried that. And it does sound a lot like King Solomon, because we know he seemed to have tried just about everything under the sun. But let me read us Ecclesiastes 1:1-9. The introduction I put on there was something I found somewhere, and I thought it was very apropos that life is not like a piece of chocolate, as what's-his-face says, but it is like a chocolate bunny. It looks good on the outside, but it's hollow. Have you ever felt that way? That, you know, even in the greatest moments, the next morning it kind of seems like, is that all there is? Is that all there was? Or even in the worst moments, it seems like, well, but I'm just disappointed about life. And I think we all face those times. And so God gave us this book so that we could know how to enjoy life. I think that's really the key to understanding the book of Ecclesiastes, is how do we enjoy life? You know, there are people who think that God doesn't want us to enjoy anything, that we should never smile, that we should never joke, that we should never be happy, dance, sing. I think they've missed the point. I don't think our God is a killjoy God. I think, though, that sometimes we try to make enjoyment the absolute wrong thing. And so I want to read the words of the book, beginning with verse 1. I'm reading from a newer translation, New Living Translation. It reads like this. These are the words of the teacher, King David's son, who ruled in Jerusalem. Everything is meaningless, says the teacher. Completely meaningless. What do people get for all their hard work under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth never changes. The sun rises and the sun sets and then hurries around to rise again. I like that illustration. The wind blows south and then it turns north. Around and around it goes, blowing in circles. Rivers run into the sea, but the sea is never full. And when the water returns again to the rivers and flows out again to the sea, everything is wearisome beyond description. No matter how much we see, we're never satisfied. No matter how much we hear, we're not content. History merely repeats itself. It has all been done before. Nothing under the sun is truly new. Sometimes people say, here is something new. But actually, it is old. Nothing's ever truly new. We don't remember what happened in the past. And in future generations, no one will remember what we are doing now. I'm going to wait and read the conclusion a little bit later. But that's the introduction. And then as you look at verse 12, you'll see that it changes voice from the teacher saying to I, the teacher, was king of Israel. So let's look at a brief outline that you have before you. The title of is Ecclesiastes, or in the German, it's called Preacher, the Preacher, which is just as good, because actually Ecclesiastes is a transliteration from the Greek word, yes, or the Hebrew word, Latin word probably, that just takes it, the word, and changes it over word for word, or letter for letter, sound for sound, into English. So there isn't really such a word as Ecclesiastes. Ecclesia, the Greek word, is the word for the church, the called out ones, those who are called out. And Ecclesiastes has kind of that ring to it of a teacher or a preacher. But traditionally, it's translated teacher or preacher. The author, Jewish tradition, and there's nothing wrong with Jewish tradition, says it's Solomon, but his name is not mentioned. So we don't have to be set that it has to be Solomon. It's not mentioned in the book that it is Solomon. The description seems to fit him very well. He was very rich. He tried all the pleasures. He tried everything. And it sounds like him. But some of the style sounds like the one writing is against a monarch. And so that maybe it would be a subject that was writing about the king. We're not sure. The date, like the authorship, is not set. And when you have a book in the Bible where the authorship and the date are not clearly set forward, the conclusion you can draw is that those aren't really that important. What's important is the message of the book. And so you can go either way on the author and the date. It's not as important as what is the message. The form of the book is poetry and prose. So that part of it's poetry, part of it's not poetry. And it does seem to meander around. It doesn't take one subject and stick with it. It kind of jumps over here, and then it jumps back over here. Death is mentioned over here, and then meaninglessness over here. There are some general subjects that are mentioned. Wealth is mentioned very clearly. Pleasure is mentioned very clearly. The accumulation of goods is mentioned very clearly. But it's kind of like life. You know, it kind of moves around. The subjects range from searching but not concluding to emptiness in life, to work that has no lasting consequence, to death which is certain for all, and to wisdom that does not have all the answers. One of the things you see as you read through the wisdom literature, it is not God saying to us, if you just know this, everything's going to work out. It's God saying to us, your wisdom is not strong enough to figure everything out by yourself. And so there are some key elements that we have to hang on to. One is that we need God. We need God in every area of our life. So what's the purpose? I didn't mention under the sun is used over 100 times. So in other words, just everything that's here on the earth. And the vexation of spirit, that's the old English, or the chasing after the wind, is used many times in this book as pictures for us to get a handle on it. Man is not in charge of his own life. That's one of the conclusions that you can come to in reading this book. Man cannot understand life. We don't understand why good people die young and bad people live a long time. Man cannot understand life, you know, on any level. We have scientists who every few years come up with an idea that they can create life spontaneously. And then other scientists take a time to look at that and say, no, sorry, you did not create life. Man cannot create life. We can mess with it. We can use it. We can multiply it. We can clone people, but we don't add life to them. Okay? If the life isn't there already, we can't add it to us. One of the great arguments or proofs, if you will, that there is a God. Life is not something we can create. I used to have a lot of fun when we were in Russia, when we would go into schools and I would talk to children about why I believe in God. And I would take off my wristwatch and hold it up and say, I just found this and I discovered that it just happened by chance. And I would begin to tell them how it happened. The volcanoes came and this watch pieces came together and a sandstorm blew a bunch of sand over the top of a fire and it became glass and it landed there. And the little kids, before too long, they were all laughing at me like, what are you, crazy? That watch wasn't made by itself. That you can't make a watch by chance. And then I would talk to them about the human body. And I would ask them if they could see me and they could hear me. And I'd ask them why they couldn't understand me, because I would be speaking English through an interpreter. And we'd have a little bit of fun. But the truth is that if you can say a watch or a clock is not made by chance, how in the world could you think something as complex as this body could be made by chance? I don't care how many millions of years you put in there. You know, they keep trying to make it longer. Well, yeah, of course, but in a billion years, you know, things could really change. Yeah, right. They are going to be the same. And man has that limitation on him. We cannot make life. So, death comes to all. But in the midst of the gloom of this book, don't avoid Ecclesiastes because of the gloom. There's nuggets of truth that are wonderful. I put a couple examples on your paper there. Wisdom is better than foolishness, as light is better than darkness. Chapter 2, verse 11. God gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy to those who please Him. Chapter 2, verse 26. The whole passage from 9 to 12 in Ecclesiastes 4 really talks about the wonders of marriage. I've used it in a number of weddings. Two people are better off than one. They can protect each other. They can fill each other's needs. They can have a wonderful life together. But he comes to the conclusion that two is not enough. It needs to be a three. And the third one is God. God entwined in a marriage of two makes a perfect, wonderful marriage. Now, in the other thing that you notice in this book is that the book recommends that we enjoy life. Now, when you read it first, you might think that the author is being sarcastic because he says things like, eat, drink, and be merry. But as you read it more in depth, you understand that he's really serious about this. And let me read you these admonitions of the author that we should enjoy life. In chapter 2, verses 24 and 25, a person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This, too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without Him, who can eat or find enjoyment? Enjoyment is from God in all forms. Enjoyment in a good meal, enjoyment in great fellowship, enjoyment in the love of a mate or in the love of a family. Those are gifts from God. In chapter 3, verse 12 and 13, I know that there's nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. It's a gift of God. Again, he says. In verse 15 of chapter 8, so I commend the enjoyment of life. Because there's nothing better for a person under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany them in their toil all the days of their life. God has given them under the sun. Notice he keeps mentioning it's toil. Life is kind of a drag on us at times. But we should enjoy what God has given to us. Chapter 9, verse 7. Go eat your food with gladness. Drink your wine with joyful heart, for God has already approved what you do. Eating and drinking, God has given to us those things so that we would enjoy them and not just to survive. Okay, verse 9 of chapter 9. Enjoy life with your wife, whom you love, all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days, for this is your lot in life and your toilsome labor under the sun. Now that sounds like, you know, again, it's a downer, but what's he saying? He's saying, enjoy life with your wife. God, if God has given you a wife, you have a good thing, and you should enjoy that. And for those of you who are not married, God has other ways of fulfilling your life, okay? It's not just you have to have a wife to be happy. Yeah, and then chapter 11, verse 9. You who are young, be happy while you're young, and let your heart give joy in the days of your youth. Follow the ways of your heart wherever your eyes see, but know that for all things God will bring you into judgment. In other words, you know, when you're young, you should live it up a little bit, but don't cross the borders of breaking God's commandments, because God will bring us into account for those things. So life is to be enjoyed, but not outside of the boundaries of God's plan. What are the conclusions that we can draw? We can draw the conclusion that life is meaningless without God in the center. If God's not a part of our life, why are we here? And there are people who absolutely refuse to believe that there is a God. And I've always wondered why they go on living. Because what's the point of life if there is no God? If there is no plan? If it's just get all the gusto you can get? Is it really beat someone else down so that you can have more? Is that really what life is about? I think life is meaningless without God as the center. Seeking pleasure, wealth, accumulation of goods is meaningless if that's where you're putting your hope. If you hope to be happier because you have more, then I have sad news for you. Money does not bring happiness. Some people say, yeah, but it buys a lot of nice things. Yeah, great. Can you take them with you? No. Will they really meet the needs of your heart? No. You know, is it good that we live in a land that's a wealthy land? This is a wealthy land, okay? And we have good things. We have buildings to meet in, and we have food to eat, and we have transportation, we have those things. Are those bad? No, they're not bad. They're a gift from God. And we should enjoy them, but we should be mindful of the fact that we are stewards of all that we have. We are not owners. It doesn't belong to us. It has been loaned to us to be used in the right manner. Wisdom is better than folly. We cannot understand all that we experience. We cannot control what will come into our lives. There is no guarantees in life. We just can't control it. Can you spare yourself some sadness and some harm by avoiding certain things? Absolutely. I'm not saying that those are not good things to do. Yes, be careful with any kind of extreme. You could even eat too much chocolate cake. It would be hard, but you could. So be careful with any kind of extreme, okay? But we can't control what things come into our life. And then God has ordered everything according to his purpose. One of the things that as we study God's word, we recognize that often the very things that we want to avoid in life, God allows come into our life so that he can do something different in our lives. God is more concerned about your salvation than he is about your comfort. God is more concerned about you living eternally than he is you living happily or healthily upon this earth. And we have plenty of illustrations of that, plenty of illustrations of people who are born with no arms and no feet, and yet they enjoy life. How can that be? People who struggle with regimes over their head. I mentioned, I think, last week that the book of Philippians that we're going to study at the retreat, rich book, keeps saying to us, you know, rejoice in the Lord. Rejoice. Again, I'll say rejoice. It was written by a man who was in prison facing death. God has answers that we don't understand. The conclusion, turn with me to the end of the book, because we should read the conclusion of the book from the book, okay? Chapter 12. Verses, I think I'll read the whole conclusion, 8 through 12. You guys are going to stay around because we have fellowship tonight anyway, so it's okay. Everything is meaningless, says the teacher, completely meaningless. So the teacher reminds us that, okay, this is what I've told you, and it's still true. Keep this in mind. The teacher was considered wise, and he taught people everything he knew. He listened carefully to many proverbs, studying and classifying them. The teacher sought to find this just the right words to express truth clearly. And that sounds very much like Solomon, because that's what he was doing. The words of the wise are like cattle prods, painful but helpful. One of my favorite verses over in the New Testament says that we should provoke one another to good deeds. That's actually the word that's used in Hebrews, that we are to gouge, to stick one another to good deeds. So once in a while we need that, don't we? Well, maybe you don't, but I do, okay? I won't claim that on you. The words, okay, I read that part. Their collected sayings are like nail-studded stick with which the shepherd drives the sheep. But my child, let me give you some further advice. Be careful, for writing books is endless and much study wears you out. Now every student says amen right there, right? Much study wears you out. Yeah, you're tired of all the studying. That's the whole story. And here now is my final conclusion. Fear God and obey His commands, for this is everyone's duty. God will judge us for everything we do, including every secret thing, whether good or bad. Those secret things, those things that nobody else knows, God knows them. Those words and thoughts that you would be embarrassed if we would put them on the screen up here, God knows them. He knows you through and through. And He will judge you for those things, except for the fact that in Christ Jesus we are forgiven and they are wiped away and they are clean. In Christ we are forgiven and we are changed into His image. Now, how can we really enjoy life? What should we do? This is plans for a party, okay? Number one, recognize the need of God in our lives. When Jesus was here upon the earth, He taught the very same thing. He said, what can a man give in exchange for his soul? What if a man gains the whole world and loses his soul? What good is that to him? So you can be the richest person on earth, but if you don't know God, if you're not in a relationship with Him, your life is empty and meaningless. Secondly, accept life with gratitude. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. Shifting shadows. That's hard to say. Every good thing that comes into your life is from God, and you should accept it with thanksgiving. Thanksgiving. I've met people, I've talked to people who say, yeah, well, I've earned everything I have. I worked hard. I strived and studied long, and I worked hard, and so I earned it. And my only question to them is, wow, how did you have strength to do that? What amazing thing that you, how did you get that mind that you could study so well? How did you get the strength that you have? Why were you born with two hands and not with just one or none? Why were you given life in the very first place? All of that comes from God. And everything that we earn, there's nothing wrong with earning. God has nothing against riches, by the way. He has against hoarding and against greediness, but He's not against wealth. As long as we recognize that it comes from Him and we use it to please Him. So accept life with gratitude. Thirdly, know the measure of our capabilities and use the gifts God has given us. 1 Peter 4:10 says, each of you should use whatever gift you have received to serve others as faithful servants, stewards of God's grace in its various forms. Every Christian has been given certain spiritual gifts. Every human has been given and it has certain talents and abilities. Some people are better at learning languages. Some people can sing like these lovely ladies that sang up here for us. I like the one song says that when we get to heaven, we're all going to sing perfectly. I like that because I'm a long ways from that here. But the things that God has given to you, use them. How? To make yourself famous? To get a lot of money? No. What does it say? To serve others. Use your spiritual gifts. Use your talents and abilities to serve others. And God will make your life enjoyable. You will enjoy life by serving others and helping others. And finally, no, it's not finally. It's fourthly. Enjoy and remember God in all we do. My favorite verse, it was on my cake last week. Thank you for making that cake with that verse on it. John 10:10, the second part. The first part says the thief comes to steal. Second part says Jesus said, that's not the part, it's my favorite part, okay? don't get me wrong. It's 10b that I like, okay? Jesus said, I am come that you might have life and that more abundantly. That in the overflowing, that in the wonderful vastness of God. That's a wonderful verse. And that really tells us what Jesus was all about. He didn't come to condemn sinners. He didn't come to cause hardship in your life. He came that you might have life and that more abundantly. Abundantly. Not based upon how much you have or don't have, how much you accomplish or don't accomplish, but how much He is real in your life. Enjoy and remember God in all we do. And finally, the words that are here, fear God, which doesn't mean that we're afraid of Him, although a little bit of fear is not a bad thing, okay? It usually keeps us out of trouble, doesn't it? You know, when you're a little kid, you have no fear. You reach up and grab the hot pan. Whew! And then you don't do that anymore because you learn that that's not a good thing. A little bit of fear is not a bad thing. My wife's afraid of snakes. And she has never been bit by a snake. It works, okay? So it's good to be afraid of some things. But in this case, it is to respect God as He is God and we are not, and keep His commandments. That's the part that I think some of us struggle with, the keeping the commandments. We say, oh, well, that limits my enjoyment in life. I probably told this story before, but I'll tell it again because it was so stark. As a ministerial student, one of the things that we did on Sundays to get practice is we went to preach. And we would go to nursing homes where people were not able to listen to us sometimes. Sometimes they did. But we also went to jails. Great place to go. You have a captive audience. Nobody can leave, you know. And it was at one of those meetings at a jail that afterwards, after one of us would preach, then we would talk to the different prisoners. And one close friend of mine, who was a missionary as well, was talking to a man, and the man was holding the bars. And he said, I don't ever want to become a Christian. And John said, why not? And he said, Christianity is too confining. And John had to look at the bars and realize, oh, wait a minute, you're on the inside. Sin is confining. Christianity is freeing. But keeping His commandments is essential to that freedom. You've all heard the story, children's story, of the railroad, of the engine on the train. Choo-choo, you know, there's lots of stories about engines on train, and they talk. And the one engine said, I'm not going to follow these dumb tracks. They limit where I can go. I'm going to go where I want to go. And so off the tracks he went, out across the field. And of course he was stuck. Because trains have no freedom when they get off the tracks. Christians have no freedom when you get away from the commandments of God. The commandments are there for what purpose? To limit us? No. To set us free. To set us free. That's what the commandments of God. If you doubt that, read it in the Old Testament. And it says over and over again, I've given you these commandments that you would have full life, meaningful life. As the Father has loved me, Jesus said, so I have loved you. Now remain in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will remain in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commands and remain in His love. Is it possible for us to keep all the commandments perfectly all of our life? No. We've all sinned and fall short of the glory of God. But is it possible by God's grace to live and to take a step, one step at a time, following the commandments of God? Absolutely. There are no commandments given that are impossible for you to fulfill if you allow God to work in your life and give you the strength for that. That's the essential part of keeping the commandments, is that we're relying on Him. Relying on Him. I mean, when we were in Russia, the cities had electric buses. I probably some German towns used to have electric buses too, and they had these two things up on top that go along the wires. And because the roads were not really good where we were, they would hit bumps every now and then, and those connectors would fall off, and the driver, the bus would stop. Hopefully you were holding on to something, because it would stop immediately. And if you weren't holding on to something, you rushed into the people in front of you, because Russian buses are always full. So you didn't get killed, but you just bounced off of people. But the driver would have to get out, no matter how cold it was and how stormy, whatever, and climb the side of the bus, get up on the top, and get a hold of that arm and stick it back on those two lines. Because without that source of power, that bus wouldn't go. Those two lines, those two bars that reach up, that's our prayer life. You got to get a hold of the power of God. When you are in connection with Him, you have power to serve Him. So, the end conclusion of the book of Ecclesiastes is get out there and enjoy life, folks.